Hello, Mike here. Today's guest doesn't just have an outrageous career of hits behind him, but he was cracking fun too. In the episode, Chris and I discuss transitioning from acting to writing, the number one key skill to have to make it in the entertainment business, dealing with failure, making the move from comedy writing to drama, how to plan out one of TV's most successful detective series, his daily writing process, humanity in murderers, the best piece of advice he's ever been given, and more. That's enough from me. Here we go. Hello and welcome to Red Carpet Rookies. My name is Mike Battle, a film crew member turned screenwriter working in London. Each episode, I bring you life lessons and stories from the people behind your favourite movies and shows to help demystify the business for aspiring filmmakers and fans alike. Thanks for joining me. Let's get started. Today's guest is the king of British detective drama writing. Having discovered his talent for the written word whilst in a comedy troupe with a pre-movie star Hugh Grant, my guest later transitioned to drama, where he has produced over 100 hours of primetime television, including a multitude of hits, including Innocent, which pulled in 8 million viewers on ITV, The Thief, His Wife and the Canoe, which was watched by 10 million in 2022, and picked up our guest a BAFTA nomination, as well as a pick of the year slot in the New York Times, and of course, his soon-to-be 6th series of record-breaking detective drama Unforgotten. Along the way, according to his IMDb at least, he also appears to have had a stint as a voice actor in the Harry Potter video game series, What Can't He Do? My guest is Mr. Chris Lang. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. Lovely intro. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now, Chris, the question that I ask all of my guests first up is, what did your parents do and did it affect your career choices moving forward?
Oh, that's a good question. My mum was an art teacher and my dad started out as a salesman and then became an antique dealer. And I would say yes, their work and the professions that they chose hugely influenced my ability, desire to enter the industry I did. I obviously came in at a slightly different angle to where I ended up, which was as a writer and producer, but I started out as an actor. And when you have parents that are connected to the arts, they both were. Obviously, mum was started out as a sculptor, then she became a teacher. My dad, although he started out from a very working class background, started work at 14 during the war and became a salesman. When he moved into buying and selling antiques, that was his true passion. And my mum and dad actually met at art school. And when you have parents who are connected to the arts and creative industries, the importance of them enabling someone who wants to go into such a precarious and difficult, and at that time in the late 70s, when I decided what I wanted to do, such a sort of esoteric profession was, you know, it's incalculable how important it was that they supported me. When I went to my careers master, when we all had our careers chat in the, I don't know what it was, like fifth year or sixth or something like that, I was at a grammar school. And I said, I think I might want to go to a drama school, the Royal Academy, which is the one I had my eyes on, which was the one that I ended up going to. I was the first person ever at my school to wow. express that desire. I go back to my old school a fair amount to do chats and talk to some of the students. And, you know, they've got a bespoke theatre, you know, drama and the entry into the arts is now understood, hugely legitimate career. And no problem whatsoever with kids going into the arts. But in the 70s, it was really an extraordinary thing. So to have the support, my mum and dad, who came from the arts themselves, my mum's dad was a musician. So, you know, it's really hard to overestimate how important that is to have the support and the belief in your parents. And they didn't laugh. They didn't say, don't be absurd. They didn't say, this is just an impossibly difficult industry. They just said, if that's what you really believe in and that's where your passion is, yeah, go for it.
Amazing. And I guess, yeah, you're going against the grain slightly, particularly when you are at a more traditional grammar school. And I wondered if perhaps in your 20s or those early years where you were pursuing the arts, if you had any kind of mental anguish over your choice, in the sense that I also have potentially made the same choice as yourself, also going to grammar school, and maybe looking at some of your friends who went into more corporate jobs that may have paid out a little earlier and things like that. Did you struggle at all with that in those early years?
Never. No. I never had a single doubt that I'd chosen the right profession And I had some difficult times. I mean, I'm not going to try and pretend that my career was harder. Of course, it was hard. I'm not going to say that it was, I was really troubled at any time. There were loads. I mean, I'm quite good at absorbing failure. I had a huge amount of failure. Everyone does in this industry. You have way more failure, even now, way more failure than you do success. But I was lucky to be blessed with the constitution that just sucked it up and carried on. That would be one of my sacred dictums to anyone in this industry. It's not talent. It's not luck. I mean, it is partially those things. But the key ingredient you have to have for this industry is perseverance. Because you can learn the others. I mean, particularly screenwriting, less so acting, because I think that is a gift. I think you're born or not. You can get better at it by doing it, but your essential talent, I think, is God-given. Writing is a craft. I believe that it's like a craft like almost any other that you can largely learn over the years. So if you just stick at it and persevere and keep going, but I'm talking, decades here, you should prevail in the end. And lots of people, of course, can't do that for all sorts of reasons, financial reasons, or they just literally can't deal with the endless rejection and failure. And I get that. But if you're lucky enough to be born with a constitution and a really tough inner, an external toughness that allows you to shake off the disappointments, then I never found myself so discouraged that I thought I've made the wrong choice. I to this day, I'm just incredibly grateful that I found the thing I more or less always enjoy doing. I mean, lots of times it's hard and boring and demoralizing, but most of the time it's a lot more enjoyable than most people's jobs, is my guess.
I think you're probably right there. Funnily enough, I, in my research, saw one of your old diary posts from one of those early years where you'd been talking about, I quote, "I've been born with a meager talent for writing and I'm eking out a living by it, but I'm not brilliant at it." How do you reflect on that now?
I forgot about that. That was an interview I did for, funnily enough, I was thinking about that podcast because it's called The Bottom Drawer. No, it's called Offcuts.
Yes. It gave me hope, that quote.
Yeah, well, it should give you hope, because here's the funny thing. One of the things that I put in there, the premise of the podcast was that can you read out, or they perform 5 or 6 or 7 pieces of work that you'd written that never saw the light of day. And, it could be an unwritten novel, a screenplay that never got made. I had lots to draw on, diary entries, da-da-da-da-da. But funnily enough, one of the things that I read out was one of my passion pieces that never got made. Has just been greenlit. Yeah. So 6 years after I had it read out on that podcast, it's just been greenlit. So there's a good example of perseverance. Never give up.
Congratulations. Was it testament?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. But I sort of, I think that what I wrote in that diary entry was kind of accurate. I was born with a moderate talent. I probably had a good ear for dialogue. I'm quite good on structure, and I like the puzzle of structure, like a chess game or a jigsaw. I like the satisfaction of making everything fit. But these are not huge gifts. But over the years of learning, since I wrote that entry, I've written, it's actually, you said in your intro, 100 hours, it's actually about 150 hours. That's a lot of telling, if you do that amount of stuff, and that's just the stuff that's been made. Obviously, I've written a lot more than that never got made. So, you just, by repetition, simply, you learn how to do this quite difficult job better. I have parlayed my modest and meager talent into a half decent career.
I'd say it's a little more than that, Chris. But yes, you said obviously you found your talent for the writing and all that, but it wasn't your original love, given that you went into acting as your first choice. Was it a hard thing to walk away from, or were you very much like, no, actually, this is what it should be?
It wasn't hard at all. I knew pretty much the first time I set pen to paper, which was at Nottingham Playhouse with, as you mentioned before, I did a comedy show with two guys, one of which was Hugh Grant. And the first time we wrote something together, it was just Hugh and I, actually. I remember feeling a great energy and a great sense of satisfaction that I'm not sure I ever got from acting. I liked the idea of creating, fully creating, rather than interpreting. And I never shook that from that very first moment. And that was within 3 months of leaving RADA. So I, although I did carry on acting for maybe another 10 years maximum, my heart was never fully in it. Who knows what might have happened if certain things had have panned out, you know, differently, and our comedy show had in the end done better. I mean, it did pretty well at the time, but if it had taken us to the next level, maybe I would have stayed in that, become more of an actor writer. But, you know, no doubt being an actor is an incredibly enjoyable job, stimulating mentally and often great fun. But the life is really tough, and I didn't enjoy that at all. Having no control, being something of a control freak, I want to control my future and my destiny and my career, and I want to control my creative impulses. I don't want someone else telling me when I can and can't do the thing that I love to do. So, I mean, I write every day and have done for 40 years. And no, it doesn't matter if no one buys it. I'm still doing the thing that I enjoy. Luckily, most of the time these days, people do buy it and they do mostly make it. But even if they didn't, I think I'd still do it.
Interesting. You mentioned the comedy writing there was obviously your way in, but you, I guess, made your huge later success from the drama genre. And this seems to be quite a common path for a lot of original comedy writers. I heard recently Terence Winter, who wrote Boardwalk Empire and Wolf of Wall Street, saying that originally he couldn't even imagine himself writing anything longer than a 22-page sitcom. How did you approach that? Did you actively be like, I want to write drama? Did it just happen? You mentioned that you were into structure, which obviously comes into a lot of your later work.
Yes, I've written a couple of spec screenplays, one with Hugh and one in the 80s. And again, really enjoyed it. And all the time that I was doing this, I was writing comedy for other people. I was writing a lot of commercials, funny commercials. I was writing anything that anyone would pay me to do. I was writing a lot of sketches for the people on the telly at the time, none of whom you'll now know, but they were the main comics of the day in the 80s. But it never felt fully satisfying. I wanted to tell stories about a human condition. So I then did write a spec screenplay with the express intention of it getting me onto a show. And it did. I was incredibly lucky. My plan, well, it went to plan completely. So I wrote a screenplay, which actually, funnily enough, later became my first original series. It was about selling. It was the British answer to Glengarry Glen Ross. It wasn't anywhere near as good as that, but it got me onto the bill. So that was my plan. If I write a spec screenplay, showed it to my agent, he said, yeah, this is not dreadful and I can send this out. And my agent at that point was negotiating deals for me to write gags for people like Michael Barrymore and, you know, light entertainment comedians who I'd somehow, well, the money was good, been drawn into it. And it really was, I was finding it very creatively wrong and unsatisfying. So she was slightly surprised to see this full-length feature spec land on her desk. But, you know, she ran with it and sent it out. And I got an interview at the Bill, which was a, you know, very important staging post for a lot of writers. And I went in, did an interview for them. And I got a gig. They offered me the opportunity to write a script, which would have been my first drama script ever written on telly. And it was a half-hour format, and it was on ITV, so it was only 24 and a half minutes of actual material. It took me a year to write. I mean, I was doing other stuff, but that's that. It was a structure that it wasn't a serialized series. Each episode was standalone. They were like tiny little play for today's. And that meant that I could take as long as I had a really good script editor and we just worked on it. It was her first job, my first job, and we just worked on it over a period of a year. And then it got made. And it was a massive, massive buzz to watch a drama rather than just a 5-minute sketch or a 2-minute sketch or a one liner on telly, which I'd had a lot of in the preceding 7 or 8 years. To see your first half hour drama, I remember sitting in a little screening room down at the production office down in South London, just being so happy that I'd written a drama, and it felt like I was a proper writer. And from that, everything led from that.
I love that. I can hear it in your voice when you say it. Do you think that, you mentioned the word staging post there, writing for stuff like Casualty, The Bill, is a really great way in for writers, isn't it? Because we don't necessarily have the same writers' rooms and stuff as American style. For the screenwriters of today, would you say that those places still exist to write for in the smaller way, or it's changed quite a lot, I guess?
It's changed, but there are lots of There are still lots of shows not dissimilar to it. There's, I think, Doctors is still running in the afternoon. Shows like Father Brown, which is daytime TV. Shows like Casualty still going. Holby's finished, hasn't it? The soaps, obviously. You know, this is where 90% of British writers would have started on one or other of those. I never did the soaps, but The Bill wasn't a billion miles away from a soap half-hour format. Played three times weekly in the end. Yeah, and if you know, you obviously don't, I wrote 12 or 13 episodes of it. So, you know, I was on it for two or three years and it taught me a huge amount, not least economy, because in 24 and a half minutes, you've got to really be economical to tell a three-act story. You know, it's quite a challenge.
Absolutely. To move on to some of your more recent work, one of the questions I would love to ask you is, when you're designing a world, for example, in something like Unforgotten, do you have much of a process? What do you start with first? Because they are so expansive. I think, you know, someone like Stephen King begins with a situation over the character, other people character first. Do you have a mental roadmap that you use?
Yeah.
Particularly given that you're so many series down now, I imagine it's bit more of a process.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes quite prescribed by the time you get to write the sixth, because you know what works. Mm. And you process that can be utterly terrifying trying to create 6 hours of television. It's you are always drawn towards things that have worked before in terms of the process. So yeah, I have a pretty prescribed process now. What I start with first is a theme. What do I want to say? What do I want to write about? And it's the last two series, well, one that's just gone out and the one that I'm writing now, are both much more political. In one, I examine friendship, male friendship. In one, I examine child sex abuse. In one, I examined our relationship with the police, if I would describe it. I write a pitch for each series, which is like maybe 5, 6, 7 pages, which outlines the primary theme. So series four was both a j'accuse and a love letter to the police. So it had that sort of, you know, why have we got such a, we have a relationship that's quite schizophrenic with the police. We both love them and loathe them in this country, and for good reasons both. So yeah, I do that. I write a 6-7 page outline, a theme, broad strokes of the plot and the key antagonists. And then when that gets the tick, I then go away and write a very detailed storyline. And the process I use is always the same. I write the characters, the antagonists' characters' storyline first, episode by episode. So I know what all their major beats are at the end of every episode and where they've got to. And then slightly weirdly, I thread the investigation through that. So I put the investigation afterwards. And so when I'm writing the characters, I will put down markers, say, big investigative turn here. I don't necessarily know what that is at that point, but I know that something rhythmically has to shift in their story. And so therefore I will create the investigative twists and turns and revelations. And that's how I do it. And that works. And I'm writing this new series now, and I'll probably apply quite a similar structure to that. When you have a multi-stranded series with multiple characters, I find it much less daunting to break it down into manageable sections. And if you're, you know, the idea of creating story, interweaving story for 5, 6, 7 characters is really mind-bogglingly difficult. But if you say, this week, I'm just going to work through one character and take him from the beginning to the end, and then the next week, I'm just going to do another character, it becomes very doable. Because it then, you know, if you say you give yourself 4 or 5 weeks to do this, it's not that hard to write. You know, that might give you a week to write one character's episodic journey, which means you might have a day or so to write one episode of the journey. And that doesn't seem that hard to me. You just have to think of some things that happen.
It's a good way to describe the job.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes the stuff up.
Yeah. And do you have like a specific writing process each day? Like, you know, a certain amount of hours you write, or, you know, sit down at this typewriter. I can't write here. I write anywhere. I write in cafes.
Well, I can write anywhere, but I don't tend to. I tend to work mainly in my office. I used to write a lot in Soho House because I like to sit at a chair looking out on Dean Street. But my back plays up too much for me to do that now. So I tend to sort of work from home more, and I work on a laptop almost exclusively. I got a sit down, stand up desk. So I'm constantly trying to sit on the sofa with a lectern in front of me. I try and mix it up as much as possible. Mm. But yeah, I get to the desk at pretty much 8:30 every morning. I do some stretches so that my tired old body doesn't collapse under me. And I'm writing by 9 at the latest. This morning, actually, I was writing by about 7:15 because I woke up early and I thought, why not? And I'll generally work through till about 6, something like that.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's never less than 8 hours, really. I don't take a lunch break. I just grab a sandwich and bring it up to my office.
Very cool. One of the questions I wanted to ask you is the numbers that your shows pull in are absolutely massive, and particularly for like the modern day of streaming with unlimited options and this and that. Is there anything that you've ever thought about, you mentioned theme there, with your own work on and why it seems to connect so viscerally with people in the modern age? Because as I mentioned, you know, streaming options, the TV, anyone could choose anything now, and yet everybody seems to be choosing yours each time. 10 million, 8 million, it's unbelievable. Have you ever thought that there's a thread? Humanity, I guess, is something you talked about before.
It is unbelievable. It's the third most watched show of the year. Yeah, I think I write shows where I try and connect with both the characters and therefore vicariously with the audience, where they can see some of themselves in the people. Even when I'm writing about people who have committed the worst sins, I always strive to understand how they've come to this place, how they've stepped over that line, because I think we are all quite close to it. And I've talked a lot about in the past, you know, compassion and forgiveness. You know, just we're doing this chat as the fallout still continues from Phil Schofield's misdemeanors. And I'm still staggered, you know, even though he's done something pretty reprehensible. I am staggered by the relish with which people are celebrating his, you know, total destruction. And whilst I think he absolutely deserved, you know, censure and punishment, I'm not sure that I think the ending of a career for good seems proportionate. And there's very little compassion in the response to him. Because you can be angry with someone and you can want them punished, but the desire for destruction and annihilation seems a curious impulse. And a lack of attempt to understand why people might have done bad things. So I think my shows try to do that. It was really interesting watching the Canoe show on Twitter, because I knew that people were going to come to it with a very strong sense of outrage at the fact that we were even dramatizing this woman's story because of what she'd done and how people felt she had so maligned and betrayed her children, which she absolutely had done. But, you know, there was a reason. There's always a reason. There's always a reason why people transgress, and often it's to do with their own personal tragedy and pain and damage, almost always. And so watching that journey of the audience as I sort of set out the stall and showed this woman without trying to mitigate at first, just show the events, and then slowly you begin to understand why she did what she did and how controlled she was and how coercive he was. And I just watched the audience slowly grow and change. And people that are absolutely violently opposed to even the idea of this story being told, and certainly opposed to her, completely flipped and said, my God, this poor woman, how outrageous was it that she was sent to jail for a sentence of 6 years and 6 months? And that's, you know, that you can only do that if you're engaging with the character in a compassionate way and saying, you can still say someone did something terrible, but you can also reach for forgiveness and understanding. There's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't undermine that they did something bad, but it helps us move forward. I think, you know, there's always a message of hope in my stuff, I think. There's always a message of this terrible thing has happened, so how can we learn from it? How can we make something better? And maybe that's why it connects with people.
Yeah, and that's something that everyone wants to believe in, regardless of what they're saying on Twitter, as their human base, I'm sure, which is probably why everyone wants to watch them.
Yeah, I think so. You know, watching, again, the audience on Series 5 of Unforgotten and watching them come to that show again with pain and resentment that the lead had gone and the character had gone. And then watching, you know, this prickly, difficult character come into it, and again watching the audience slowly get to know her, see her pain, see her, understand who she was, and the fact that she was going through a deeply traumatic time, and slowly warm to her, and then you know, the relationship blossoms and they find connection with each other, those two protagonists. And the audience really responded to that. And they, of course, they want it to be good. We all do. We want things to work out. We know it's difficult and there's a million vicissitudes that we'll face along the way. But in the end, we've got to kind of hope for the best. And sometimes it does happen. Often it happens. And I think, you know, I will always try and leave the audience with a sense of hope.
Thank you for that wonderful answer. Now, to wrap up on Red Carpet Rookies, Chris, I ask all of my guests the same few questions, which is based on the Actors Studio questionnaire. So just think of the first thing that comes into your head, if that's okay. The first question is, what is one of the best pieces of advice you've ever been given?
When I was thinking of forming my own company, which I did then go on to do, I remember I spoke to an exec at a company that I was working for, who owned his own very successful company. And I said, what advice would you give to me? He said, never lose your temper with a commissioner. And actually, never lose your temper or get frustrated with, well, try never to do it, because whoever it is you're working for, if it's a junior, really junior producer, it's a script editor, it's a whatever, it's quite likely that one day they will be the commissioner. And they will remember that you were that arsehole that got cross with them. So always smile, always take rejection and the no's that are an inevitable part. Just take them with a smile, even if inside you want to leap up and throttle them. Just take it with a smile. And it's good advice. It's really good advice, because it's hard to accept rejection endlessly for, you know, decades. And as I said earlier, I'm still taking it now. But do it with a smile and you'll find life will be easier.
Love that. Number two, do you have a favorite film?
God, that's a tough one. But yeah, I guess I would probably say, it goes back to my earlier answer about structure, I'd probably say Groundhog Day. I think it's the most exquisitely, perfectly structured film ever made. And of course, it's a brilliant character study and it's very, very funny. So it's hard to fault it.
Cool. Number three, what gives you a reason to get out of bed every day for a day of writing?
I haven't lost the desire to tell a story. I love telling stories. And my wife is always saying, you're never going to stop and retire. And I say, oh, no, I will. And she say, no, someone will ring you up and say, oh, do you fancy this story I've just read in the paper? Would you like to adapt it? And I'll go, ooh. Because you just want to get into it and try and work out why people did what they did.
I love that. I know that feeling. Number four, which job in the industry would you do if you weren't doing yours?
I think I would have directed if life circumstances hadn't have intruded.
Number five, if you could work with one person living or dead, who would it be?
I would love to have written and to have worked with, although I did work with him very briefly, but written something for Tony Hopkins.
Lovely. Number six, what is a book, ideally career-focused, but doesn't have to be, that everyone should read?
Well, I never read a screenwriting book in my life, but a book about screenwriters is the William Goldman book, Adventures in the Screen Trade, which, you know, every young writer should read. It's brilliant, funny, insightful. And, of course, the first line in the fly leaf, which is no one knows anything, is a great piece of advice.
Classic. And finally, if you won an Oscar, who would you thank, Chris?
I would thank... I would thank my mum and dad, even though they're no longer here, but I would thank them because they gave me everything.
Which takes us back to our first question and then bringing you into the arts. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris, for your wisdom and advice. It's been brilliant.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Red Carpet Rookies. To help us grow and be able to interview more amazing film and TV professionals, please do subscribe and drop us a rating on the Apple Podcast Store on your iPhone or online if you're an Android user. If you're interested in regular updates, the best thing you can do is to join our mailing list at redcarpetrookies.com, or alternatively, find us on Instagram at redcarpetrookies or Twitter at rcrookiespod. I also tweet regularly about my own learnings in the business at Mike F. Battle on Twitter, so please do come and say hi. Thank you again for listening. We'll see you next time.